gentlemen, I've often said that we have the most intelligent listeners on the planet right here at 9, 10 a.m. the Superstation. And about three or four weeks ago, I had a listener call in. He said, Steve, you need to check out the Public Lighting Authority because there was a public safety fund set up, and that fund was destroyed by the public lighting. It was used to partially fund the purchase of the new LED streetlights in Detroit. I said, nobody would be so short-sighted as to do that. That's impossible. But I researched it. I called my good friend, former state representative Maureen Stapleton, and she pointed me in the direction of the next guest. She told me how the legislation was done, and here he is, the man, the myth, the legend, the survivor, State Senator Burt Johnson.
Hey, good morning, Steve. How you doing?
Man, I'm doing great. Can you clear up this public safety fund thing? Because evidently you wrote the legislation. Can you clear that up for me, please?
Yeah, well, as a component of establishing the Public Lighting Authority and funding it and that kind of thing, you got to put a funding mechanism in place for these things. One of the caveats and one of the carrots, frankly, in order to get this thing through and bring Detroiters on, but also to entice other folks across the state to see the value in it, because we had some need here in the city of Detroit, was to also establish a small pot of money that would be collected each year as well that would serve the interests of our public safety officers. And that gives them the opportunity to buy more equipment, to do the things that they need to do to keep us safe here in the city of Detroit. And if my memory serves me correctly, we are going to be raising on average, and this is just a very conservative estimate, about $18 million a year into that fund. And what it does is it gets sent over to the city of Detroit's general fund, and then that, you know, can be moved in the direction of the public safety officers. Now, the city of Detroit can always do whatever it wants to do with the money, but it is earmarked for public safety.
All right. So out of the money. Okay. So how was the Public Lighting Authority funded, first of all? Because you did the funding portion of it. Maureen said she did the bill that created it, but you did the funding portion of it from the Senate side. How was that done?
Well, it was done from all sides, but I understand what Maureen is pointing to. Essentially, we gather money through the cobalt tax, the hotel tax and that kind of thing, and the liquor tax in the city of Detroit. So when people come to the convention center, when they buy spirits, when they spend their money in the city of Detroit for those couple things, we section off a small pot of that money, and then we call that money that supports the Public Lighting Authority and therefore the public safety side of things in the city as well.
Let's talk about the public safety side, because it's my understanding that there was already a public safety fund that was set up, and this took money from it? You're saying it actually created
one? No, not at all. It didn't take money from it. There is a public safety pot of money, a funding mechanism already in place. All this does is increase the amount of money the city of Detroit gets for public safety. And when you look at the reason we chose the hotel and convention centers and then also the spirit side, we have a lot of people who come through the city of Detroit who are tourists and not necessarily Detroiters per se. So this is not money that necessarily comes out of the pockets of Detroiters, but more so from folks who come in to visit us. So sometimes you're looking to establish these pots of dollars because it gives you an opportunity to trap new money that is not coming from Detroiters. Lord knows Detroiters have already been taxed enough and we continue to be taxed enough. But at the same time, when people come and visit us, it gives us an opportunity to make new money. So, yes, there was already a public safety fund in place. What I wanted to do was to trap new money to assist Detroit's police officers so that when, you know, they try to do their job, they have more money to do the basic things that we hope that they are always able to do.
And you said the city throws this into the general fund. It just doesn't sit off to the side. So it could actually be being used on anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, the mayor and the city council always have the opportunity that when it's in the general fund, they can do anything they want with it, but it's earmarked for public safety.
And how much is it a year?
It's about $18 million.
$18 million a year goes into public safety. I'd really like to know what's going on with those funds. Okay.
Well, I'm going to tell you, it's probably not some great mystery, because here's the hardcore truth. Any dollar that usually gets earmarked for a particular thing in the city of Detroit for the general fund probably get spent in that direction, understanding what the need is. So, you know, follow me on this. When you have, and this is irrespective of who's mayor and who's council and all that kind of stuff, and obviously, like I said, it's within their right to make decisions about money in the general fund, but because that need exists, I'd be willing to bet that only in the instance that there wasn't a very pressing need would money that's in the general fund not be earmarked, not be both earmarked and then used to support whatever it was earmarked for. And as we all know, the need on the public safety side has not gone anywhere. As a matter of fact, it's probably increased. Mm-hmm. So the money that's traditionally collected and then the money that comes off this public lighting mechanism that was put in place is probably being used for public safety.
Mm. Okay. Interesting. All right. Interesting to say the least. Let's switch gears for a second. What's going on with your trial? Our former mayor said that he chased his lawyer around a table. There was so much angst. Did you chase your mayor around? Did you chase your lawyer around the table to get rid of him? I can't imagine you chasing Cyril Hall anywhere.
No, I did not. Cyril's a good friend. And truthfully, he and I parted ways, and it was my decision based on fundamental philosophical differences in strategic approach. Now, that sounds pretty technical. Basically, I didn't think,
or at least long-winded,
I wanted him to do. Yeah, I didn't think he was doing the things that I needed him to do. And, you know, those are tough decisions, but they're decisions you have to make when you're trying to slay a dragon like I am. And so I go into court on August 1st.
No, when those are the kind of decisions you have to make when you're trying to save that ass.
No question.
Do you want to shower with the boys? No. Do you want to drop the soap? No. You got to do what you got to do. So go ahead, Bert. I'm sorry. I digress.
So on August 1st, I'm due in court for scheduling conference, and we'll reestablish new dates for pretrial conferences, motion cutoffs, trial, that kind of thing. The judge has been, you know, pretty gracious with respect to my request. The government obviously wasn't happy, but this is how things go when you maneuver through the federal court system. So I'm encouraged. I got a great lawyer that I've been able to draw for myself. I got a great judge. I've got great facts. And so, you know, I expect some really good things to happen here in the fall.
So are you getting a government paid attorney?
I am. See? And, you know, many people misunderstand that the way that happens is you file a financial affidavit. That affidavit establishes, in front of the court at least, what your finances are. And, you know, these cases in the federal court system are very, they cost a lot to defend. And the federal defender office, which then appoints if the judge sees fit to review your finances and thinks that you are, in fact, indigent, and I've been seen as such, then they appoint someone from the federal panel. And that panel is really stocked with amazing lawyers. A lot of lawyers that you and I both know are on that panel. And
I've
found somebody who's, you know them. These are people who have built great reputations across the city of Detroit, across the country for that matter. But being determined indigent is not a negative status thing. As a matter of fact, there are people who make $250,000 a year in salary and whatnot who are in fact indigent, you know, because you're hiring, in these cases, you're hiring experts, you're hiring people who can corroborate or disprove things. And
all right.
It costs a lot to fight these cases.
Because I was just about to say, for you to be indigent, your shoes sure look better than mine. Okay. For you to be indigent, your shoes really look good, Imelda. You know,
the one or two pair of shoes that I have, Steve, I tend to take care of. You got to put a little wax on your shoes from time to time if you want them to hang around.
See, it's that whole soul brother thing. You know, I'll say this about you, Russell Woods guys. You sure know how to make the feds mad. Kwame made them mad. You making them mad. And you sure know how to get your shoes shine. Kwame got his shoes shine well. You got your shoes shine well. And both of y'all didn't like your lawyers. But that's okay. But continue, Bert.
Even in the United States Army, they keep the shoes shine. That's a matter of keeping shoes healthy, not just having them look good.
Okay, so you're indigent. All right. You're indigent. So do you think you're going to prevail in this thing, Bert?
I do. Not only are the facts on my side, I mean, there are two basic truths to search for in this thing based on what I've been charged with. Number one, she called, a former employee, called herself a ghost employee. That's just not true. There are lots of folks who can corroborate that. And number two, we have work product that supports.
So she actually did do work.
There's no question about it. It can be corroborated, and we will present evidence as to such. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we expect to be not only victorious, but, you know, that beautiful word that everybody says whenever they get in trouble, we expect to be vindicated. But that's not just conjecture. People who know me know that I've built a great reputation on doing work and getting things done and being a go-to guy in the legislature. I've worked there for about 16 years now, and I cut my teeth on the work. So, you know, I've never been much of a socialite and somebody who really plays around with what
your shoes tell a different story.
The status of being a politician. For me, it's just been about the work, and so we've done good work.
Well, here's the issue here. You know, the sharks are circling in the water for a potential special election. You're saying it's not going to happen. Stop circling mm-hmm. and go back out to sea. Can I take that away from this?
Yeah, they should go back out to sea.
Okay. When will
you know, my term ends? My term ends December 31st of 2018. And I'll just tell you a very quick piece. I was walking into the Capitol about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, from time to time, you know, I meditate. I get these epiphanies as I just go throughout my day. And so I was pulling up to the Capitol. And at the end of every term, those lawmakers who are not going to be returning in the new session because they're term limited oftentimes are invited to make a farewell speech. And I was thinking as I was pulling into the Capitol, I said, you know, I have a speech to make at the end of December in lame duck of 2018. And then the next thought I had was that, well, I guess I better finish my case the right way so I can be around to make that speech. Steve, I expect to make my farewell speech in December of next year. And the truth is, you know, the moment you start counting somebody out, you forget that there's something else, someone else, some other group, ancestors, the creator in charge. And the truth is, man, I didn't hire somebody who didn't do any work. I didn't hire somebody who was a ghost employee, and we'll be able to prove that.
Okay. Nobody will accuse. Well, they've accused you of hiring a spook. You say you didn't hire a spook. That's okay. A spook employee, ghost spook, like that. Anyway, Bert, I will be there for your closing speech. All right.
All right.
I remember when you first started in the Senate. Full of hope, full of promise. We had to overcome an incredible amount during that race. Were the old golf course stuff. People wouldn't let you live that down. I was like, man, let the boy go. He did his time. You know, screw it. Let him go. And then that vast area that is your district, when people talk to me about that district, oh, I want to run for Burt's seat. I want to run for Burt's seat. I said, have you seen that district?
Right.
I mean, that is the – I mean, you've got four different areas with four different, very different constituencies. And just doing the work to represent all of them is hard. And I think you've done a really good job at it. You know, that's why this one hurt me. This one hurt me more than most. These accusations hurt me more than most. Because, I mean, you did. I mean, it's almost an impossible district to serve. Because – no matter what you do, you're going to piss off one of those constituency groups.
That's right. It's probably the state's most diverse district. I got 5 Grosse Pointe, Harper Woods, Hamtramck, Highland Park, and then Detroit. And so it means that you got to be ready. You know, you got to be on a swivel so that you're dealing with people's issues. Because when they call a legislator, it's not like calling a mayor. A mayor has department heads that you can always look to. Somebody accuses the mayor in a meeting that crime is a problem, the mayor can always say, hold on, police chief, tell them what we're doing on crime. Well, as a legislator, you actually have to be nimble enough to deal with the issue, and you have to be all-knowing. So I've got to know something about everything. I don't get to stand in a room and say, hey, I don't know, let me get back to you. Mm-hmm. And in this district, the need is vast. And you're right. Representing these folks has not only been an honor, but it's been some kind of magic show because you got to be there for them. So I've had the time of my life doing it. And frankly, I wouldn't have had it any other way. This stands to sully what it is, the reputation that I've built, mm-hmm. unless and until, you know, I bring myself forward in this system. And so that's exactly what we plan to do. I don't intend to be back here, you know, crying for sympathy about a sentencing. We expect to be victorious at trial.
All right. One last thing. I got a couple minutes left. I've got to tap into your Unchained side, the mm-hmm. Bert Johnson Unchained. Is it me, or was the riot coverage over the last 5 weeks over the top?
Yeah, it's been a little disgusting, Steve. You know, I was reading some articles yesterday. It's interesting you bring this up. I was reading some articles yesterday about everyone else's. And when I say everyone else, I'm talking about folks who are not black and not Detroit and didn't even live in that era, didn't come through that time, don't know what happened. And certainly, you know, families like the Hoods, you all were there in it, living it, dealing with it, and, you know, continuing to make Detroit a better place. But everybody seems to know what's going on with our people and with our community and how this thing got started. And
oh, why don't you just say white suburbanites?
I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, white suburbanites with the whole supremacy thing and entitlement. I mean, they just know better than us. And man, it's been really, really disgusting to watch these commemorative exercises, conversations, op-eds, vlogs, you name it. And a lot of these folks, and listen, I wasn't alive in 67. I wasn't born until 73, but I know that some of the stuff these people are saying is just inaccurate and untrue. And frankly, I'd like to see if there's going to be some commemoration, Steve. I'd like to see real Detroiters who at the time were in it, leading it and talking about it. But of course, as the whitewashing of black history happens across the country, in the world for that matter, that truth is oftentimes hidden and is not told by our own people. It's disgusting.
Well, Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to be doing that here on this show.
Okay.
Wednesday,
okay.
Our signature guest is going to be Judge Debbie Ford,
okay.
Who was a little girl growing up in that area, you know, of course, with mm-hmm. her mom and her father and all that, everything going on. We're going to get her take at 8, and we have another take from the Coalition of Police Brutality starting at 7:30. We're going to try and get it, you know, we're going to try and do it straight. I mean, because when you come down to it, Bert, they do all this scholarly examination on the riot. They do all this stuff. And what it comes down to, it wasn't a raid on an after-hours joint that caused the riot. It was angry Negroes with no opportunities. And if it weren't that, it wouldn't have spread. Okay? If it weren't that, it wouldn't have spread. And the problem is, Bert, we're right where we were in 1967 with
Absolutely.
An educational system that's actually worse.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if I was off kilter and saying this stuff is just
No, you're right on point. And this is why you need people who have the history, who have the experience, who were part of this thing, who saw those tanks, who dealt with the National Guard, who lived under that martial law, who understood the politics of the time, and who dealt with being a Detroiter. And to have that conversation, I don't believe you can start on that fateful beginning day, that initiating day in 67. I think you got to go back decades to talk about the other rebellions. And there's a difference between riots and rebellions. Mm-hmm. I've always called it a rebellion. I think you have to talk about the history of the city. I think you have to talk about the mood in the city, the Purple Gang, the KKK, the white supremacy, and the people who did the worst to Detroiters. I think you got to talk about the ASEAN suites and really what happened in this city. And if we do that, I think people will then come away with a Detroiter's real-time understanding of not just what happened in 1967, but what's happening today. And it should be instructive so as to teach Detroiters, train Detroiters how to come through, you know, just another small part of our Detroit history, but this time today.
All right. Bert Johnson, we've got to go to break. We've got Steve Nevelin coming up next. We're going to talk about TARP funds. Are they being used correctly by doing all these demolitions? Wrote an excellent piece in the Metro Times. You know, if you're not doing anything, you might want to sit around and just listen to this. It's going to be a fascinating conversation.
I think I will.
And as you know, I'm going to be in the Powerhouse Highland Park right about 9:30. I'll be walking in, but I'll be leaving there around 10:45, 11:30, between that time period, depending on how far I walk. And I can stop by your house and drop you some shoes, since you indigent. Or would you like me to stop at that McDonald's on the road, get you a sandwich, since you indigent?
Hey, man, if you just ride by and stick your hand out the sunroof and wave and say hello, I will have been touched by one Steve Hood. Man, I'm glad I woke up with Steve Hood this morning.
I hate it when a guy says that. Thanks, Bert. Anyway, I'll
All
talk
right,
to you, man.
Peaceful.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, be right back. Steve Nevelin joins us after the 8 o'clock break.